Hey everyone, the reviews are coming in for our book, Death by Umbrella, The 100 Weirdest Horror Movie Weapons. Scream Magazine called it really entertaining and often amusing, like a greatest hits album with just the good kills. We're so happy they like it, and we think you will too. Pick it up in paperback, e-format, or hardcover at Amazon.com or Barnes & Noble. On with the show.
Top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
I know what you're thinking. Mine's bigger than yours, right? It's not fair. Throw it away. All right? All right!
Tell me about Disneyland.
They got tons of popcorn there.
Yeah.
And all you gotta do is go climb a tree to go eat it.
It was a night like any other night. Then something happened.
Oh, good Lord. It's unbelievable. It's horrible.
Hey, wait, there's something weird here.
Welcome to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of low-budget cinema.
The sleep of reason gives birth to monsters.
Hi, my name's Chris, and along with Jeff, we're bringing you the very best and worst of horror, sci-fi, post-apocalyptic wasteland, kung fu, women in prison movies from the 1960s to today. Check us out at reallyawfulmovies.com, part of the Crypt TV family.
For our downtown Toronto headquarters, here's episode 129. Not Planet of the Apes, but Planet of the Vampires. And while the former had apes, the latter has no vampires. It was Earth the whole time. Yeah.
You finally made a monkey out of
it. Yeah. From Chimpan A to Chimpan Z. This is Mario Bava's 1965 lovely, gothic, picturesque space horror, Planet of the Vampires. And we love our Bava.
Uh-huh.
And you don't associate the Italian maestro with sci-fi.
Mm.
And this is his AIP sci-fi film, and we've talked about Bava in the past on our show. This is another addition to the canon, and I'm so glad you recommended I watch this, because it was great. It was a beautiful movie.
Yeah, I mean, Bava is obviously known for his horrors and his giallos. Of course, you have, your Black Sundays and your Black Sabbaths, his gothic films, but the giallos, like, The Girl Who Knew Too Much. He's known for the horror genre, but the fact of the matter is that he was a very versatile director. I mean, this movie was made in between two giallos, Blood and Black Lace and Kill Baby Kill. But as you said earlier, Bava may not be known for sci-fi, but the reality is he was an extremely versatile director. He made sword and sandal films. There was one called Knives of the Avenger. There's another one which I absolutely adore called Hercules in the Haunted World. He made a western. He made a couple westerns, one being Roy Colt and Winchester Jack. He made...
you just pick two gun manufacturers and then that becomes, like, automatically your Western?
Sure,
like,
why not?
Yeah, okay, yeah. That's the Italians for you. Like, ripping off stuff, but in their own inimitable style, making something brand new. Mm-hmm. And this falls into that category for sure.
He also made a super stylish sort of mod spy film, kind of based on a very popular Italian fumetti, which is like an Italian comic book, called Danger Diabolique, which I absolutely adore. And, even made, like, a ribald sex comedy called Four Times at Night. So,
I wonder what that one's about,
Bava making a sci-fi film, and this is a sci-fi horror, a la Alien, and the reality is that most people say that this film is a huge influence on Alien. A lot of the plot beats are very, very similar to Alien. Ridley Scott claims he's never seen Planet of the Vampires, but, there are a lot of similarities to Alien. But like every other Bava film, the visual inventiveness is unparalleled. This, Bava, not only was he a masterful director, but he worked as a cinematographer on most of his movies, too. many times he was uncredited as a cinematographer, but sometimes he would just say to the cinematographer, you're not doing a good job. I'm going to do it. I can do a better job. Yeah. And every special effect in this film was done in camera. Nothing was done post-production. Nothing was done with optical effects. It was all done using miniatures, matte paintings, forced perspective. This is pure movie making at its finest. And like I said before, the film is scrumptious. It's a feast for the eyes. It's a banquet for the senses. And it's a wonderful, neat little sci-fi movie.
And, of course, every sci-fi movie needs a spacecraft and venturing into the unknown of mm-hmm. some sort. And here we have two sister ships, the Argus, and referred to maybe as the Galleon or the Galliot. We're not exactly sure. We're going to call it the Galleon. It's some variant of galley of a ship. Mm-hmm. So the Argus is captained by Mark Markrey. And we're going to have to talk about the ship, mm-hmm. first and foremost. It's very Enterprise-esque on the outside, and much more lavish and expansive on the inside. This is not the typical submarine spaceship we've come to associate with sci-fi. This is a large, spacious, modern-looking ship.
For sure.
For what they were working with on the budget.
One of the things that Star Wars did for sci-fi is they took away a lot of the sleekness of it all. So a lot of people lauded Star Wars for the fact that the ships looked used and abused and worn and weathered, i.e. the Millennium Falcon. Alien as well. You know, the interior of ships would look like, you know, a condominium recycling room.
Yeah.
But this was in sort of the golden age of sci-fi when there was wonder and there was
hope. And we were imagining the International Space Station 40 years before it ever went into space. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, people had all these ideas of what it would look like.
And this spaceship is wonderfully expansive. It's got all these neat little doohickeys and levers and beeps and boops yeah. and flashing lights. And it's got a neat little device called the Meteor...
Meteor Rejector.
The Meteor Rejector.
Yeah, and which looks like a film projector or a viewfinder. You'd see it, you know, Grand Canyon or something, yeah.
And this quartering, yeah. View. Yeah, they have in Europe too, on top of the steeples,
the Eiffel Tower. Yeah, put a quarter in, you see really far, and that thing was hilarious. Yeah. And
but this enabled them to navigate through the asteroid fields or the meteor fields.
Yeah, even though for some reason it was inside the ship, you would have thought this would be some gun that was planted outside, but for whatever reason, it was zapping them through some newfangled technology. Mm-hmm. And again, it's a sci-fi film, so you have like a neural capacitor, contractor, laser facilitator, or whatever, all the ridiculous buzzwords, and yeah. give them credit. Like, they used all this great sci-fi gobbledygook to, mm-hmm. you know, try and infuse it with science-y, you know, legitimacy. But and this is all just great stuff. And the captain, Captain Mark, leading the charge, you know, exploring a planet because they're getting signals from mm-hmm. the planet. And
Alien. Yep.
And, you know, they decide to investigate. I mean, they're explorers.
Mm-hmm. So they're getting a signal from this planet. They're also in contact with... So this is their Captain Mark is captain of the Argus, and he's played by an American actor by the name of Barry Sullivan.
Mm-hmm.
And they're in contact with their sister ship, the Galleon. We'll just call it the Galleon.
Okay,
on my version, which is a Blu-ray, that's what they were calling it. And on the Galleon is Mark's brother. And as Mark is talking to his brother, the signal is disrupted, and the ship starts getting pulled to this planet with this tremendous
gravitational pull.
40
G's or whatever it was.
40 G's of gravity, which is enough to kill any man, and yet it's pulling them to this planet. They can't resist the gravitational pull. As they're being pulled, you got these wonderful, protracted, very Shatner-esque, Kirkian scenes of, you know, passing out. Like,
on the console, reaching for the button that puts it on manual. We're going to manual now. Yeah. Oh, I just got it.
I can't pull much
longer.
And then when they finally land on the ship quite safely, on the planet, sorry, quite safely, they come to, again, very slowly, and then inexplicably, they start attacking each other.
Yeah.
They start fighting. The only one that was unaffected by this, for reasons somewhat unexplained, is our intrepid captain. And he's able to quell the...
Yeah, I guess a weird kind of uprising. Mm-hmm. And when they snap out of it, his crew has no recollection that they've tried to sabotage the ship or tried to attack their captain. Mm-hmm. They're stunned and they're stupefied, and they've clearly been affected by whatever atmosphere is on this foggy, red kind of Mars-like planet.
Foggy, that's another thing. I mean, when they go out on this planet,
you have to have the Baba fog.
The sumptuousness of the beauty. I mean, between the lights, the fog. I mean, the rolling dry ice and the fog and the shadows and the primary colors and was it stalactites and stalagmites and whatnot?
Yeah, it's really beautiful stuff. Just and the lava and the different rock formations.
Absolutely incredible. Just a wonderful feast for the eyes. I mean, what was not a feast for the eyes were their spacesuits. Those were a little
scuba issue with these flipped up, upturned collars. Utterly ridiculous.
Kind of looks like these weird black neck braces and cradling their chins.
Yeah.
But it's the 60s. We're going to cut them some slack in the sartorial department. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, they look at the ship and they go, wait, 40 G's of gravity? We're alive? There's no damage to the ship? To the exterior, to the hull, what's going on here? And they set out exploring.
Yeah, let's try and find the galleon.
Mm-hmm.
The high-tech drawbridge lowers, and they have no space hatch. Apparently the atmosphere is just conducive to just sauntering out in without a helmet, without any oxygen. You just walk into this planet, who knows? Did they have some sort of means of detecting the atmosphere before they landed? No. Drawbridge lowers, they just step out onto the planet, start exploring, mm-hmm. start looking for the galleon people. Start looking for the galleon ship. And Where is their sister ship?
And they find it. And what they see is quite shocking to them. And I would even surmise that it was quite shocking to audiences in the 60s, because the entire crew of the galleon have perished. Mm-hmm. They're all dead. And they're all pretty bloody for a 60s movie. Blood feasts have come out, but I mean, gore was not something that you would have associated with an AIP drive-in kitty matinee picture, and there is a bit of gore and gru in this movie. And when they look at the deceased on the galleon, of course, one being Mark's brother, they realize that they basically offed each other. They fought and they killed each other, just like the crew of the Argus?
The Argus was trying to do to their captain, yeah.
So they do what they figure is the right thing to do, and that's to bury them. It doesn't really make a whole heck of a lot of sense, but
you got to give someone a proper burial, regardless of where you are. And where they are is some inhospitable planet.
Right.
And instead of just incinerating them or just digging an open grave, they cover them in some sort of weird saran wrap.
Well, the thing is, I mean, you know, ostensibly, they want to get back to their home planet. So they could just keep them on board. I'm sure they have some sort of refrigerated chamber, bury them back.
Yeah, or a morgue or something.
Where their family,
and the ship is massive.
And pay their respects.
Yeah.
You know, they bury them right then.
I never thought about that. Yeah, the family for sure. Yeah,
they bury them on this this weird, uncharted, unexplored planet, and there's these very
odd, futurist sculptures.
Yeah, these Italian-esque futurist sculptures, and they're metallic, and they sort of they're like levered, and they go down and.
It's very high-tech burial that they have in situ. They have with them, apparently, some means of burying people with a weird trapdoor contraption.
And they place the spaceman in this, what to me looked like a translucent, hefty garbage bag.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
A glad garbage bag, yeah.
It was just really...
Ziploc bag.
And, they're in this hole. It was a hole pre-shoveled. I don't know. What else have been shoveling? They place him in this hole, they place him in this bag, and then the levered metallic thing clamps shut. They're dead and buried. Or so the crew thinks, because one of the scenes in this movie, I mean, I saw this movie when I first got into Italian horror, and I started renting anything I could that was Argento, Fulci, Bava. And I remember watching this movie and thinking, well, this is not the Bava I'm expecting, this is not a GL, this is not a horror, it's even a little bit slow, but then when I saw the resurrection scene, it blew my mind, and I think I rewound it about 4 or 5 times. It was unbelievable.
Yeah, and I think the plastic Ziploc bags were purely for visual aesthetic. There was nothing...
aesthetic reasons, yeah.
And because... you know, why not? Rather than have a hand emerge from the earth, which we've gotten bored with seeing when the zombies reanimate, they actually come out of the ground in their plastic, completely encased, and then the undead rip them off, and they're back to being upright and wandering around.
They literally tear themselves out of their cocoon, out of their death cocoon. And this is rendered in slow motion with the fog rolling, and it's creepy as fuck, man. It's just creepy and beautiful and effective. Absolutely wonderful. So we know something's not right on this planet because the dead are coming back to life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and of course, we have some women as part of the crew here. Mm-hmm. And one is named Sonya. I can't remember the other one. And she sees out of the corner of her eye one of the deceased coming back to life. She passes right out in typical 60s sci-fi hysterical fashion. Mm-hmm. They don't know what to make of her. She claims, "I swear, I saw this guy. I believe it was Bert, the character who was deceased, and whose nameplate they took off and then buried him." And
the woman's name, by the way, was Kyoto.
Oh, okay. Oh, it just makes me laugh that they,
me now, yeah.
In addition to having drawbridges, they have all the high tech of nameplates. Like, they don't have like retinal scanners to identify people. It's like, take off his nameplate before you bury him. His nameplate.
It's like you work at McDonald's.
Yeah. True enough. And then, of course, you have this tension here of what she claims to see, and also the crew trying to get out of there. And after they've obviously buried their comrades and get back out and try and leave this place.
Well, yeah, and we should say one of the reasons why they can't leave is because this meteor rejector device, you know, because like the crew, they keep getting afflicted by these spells of insanity. And at one point, one of the crewmen, it might have been Bird, it might have been Wes,
the engineer, I think. Yeah, Wes, he was sabotaging the equipment, and he has no, of course, recollection of having done so. Mm-hmm. So they've got this busted viewfinder, and they can't leave the planet without a means of shooting down the asteroids and getting out of there. So they need this thing to launch.
So they do
failure
some more,
to launch
for sure, and they do some more exploring, and they come across yet another spacecraft. Now this one is like nothing we've seen before, and this is like nothing I've seen before, because outside of the spacecraft and inside are these gigantic skeletons. And are very detached and dispassionate Captain Mark. I mean, you got to think, these are astronauts, right? So they're men of science.
Yeah.
They're men of curiosity. They're spacemen. He looks at these ginormous skeletons and goes, oh, well, they look to be about 3 times our size. Well, no, they actually look to be about 30 times our size. And they mentioned, oh, they must be from some sort of ancient civilization. Let's continue exploring.
Yeah, the end. Yeah,
like, no, wouldn't that be...
No curiosity,
like,
yeah.
Let's take a sample of bone to put underneath a microscope or something.
I guess they were just so consumed with their own survival, they couldn't think to, you know, use this as a research expedition. Who knows?
But the parallels to Alien are, again, coming fast and furious. They find another race, a deceased race. These skeletons are unbelievable. The set design of that spaceship was on. Some of these shots look to me, like, improbable. Especially the fact that it was done in camera and not in post-production. It's just amazing. And ultimately, they need, of course, they want to fix this doohickey and get off the planet. But there's things happening that are just not right. You have the hysterical woman seeing
reanimated, you know, astronauts wandering about.
And then they get a visit from two members of the Galleon. And
these guys are Kier and Silas. Udo Kier? I don't know. No, yeah, Kier and Silas, and they're acting...
Tully Savalas?
And they're acting strangely, even more so than their ADR-voiced reproductions would suggest. They're very robotic, you know, even more so than some of the B-movie acting level here. They're acting extra weird for this type of movie. They're wandering around, acting very, very stilted. The captain says, you know, welcomes them back. He's glad that his comrades have survived, says, you know, as he does repeatedly through the film, maybe we need to have some rest, let's just sleep, and one of you takes watch, because they've been attacking one another, and the other takes a respite. Sure enough, these guys are not alive. They are afflicted by the same thing that hit poor Bert. They've got this gaping wounds in their face. One of them actually has his innards exposed, and he's not what he seems. So he's been buggered up by whatever atmosphere is here. We're not going to spoil it, but these two on the Galleon are not having a good time here.
And then, of course, we have the requisite scene where they explain what's going on and what their plan is. why they're doing what they're doing, and
yes,
our heroes have to fight the aliens to prevent them from going back to the home planet. And I keep saying home planet because there's a couple twists in this movie.
Yeah,
there's two twists, and one twist we sort of kind of reveal, but I really don't want to spoil it because I mean this is a real joy to behold, and mm-hmm. I really feel like, you know, even if you're not a sci-fi fan, this is a sci-fi horror. This is a spooky, eerie, creepy, beautiful work of art from Bava that is a sci-fi film, but with elements of horror, and it's just I love it.
Oh, for sure.
I love this movie. I mean, yes, there are debits. You know, we got the hokey acting, we got the stilted reading of the line, but that's explainable, because, I mean, this was shot in Italy, it was MOS, so you have an American lead actor, and then you have other actors and actresses are Italian.
Yeah, Tower of Babel, different languages yeah. being spoken, each one speaking their own language, overdubbing it in ADR. Yeah, I guess a debit I would say is I found it hard to keep track of who was who based on the scuba gear outfits and also the lack of variety in the voices. So you have all these people who look on the surface quite alike, and then just talking in the same way, all dressed the same. So that was a little bit tough to distinguish who was who, but again, that was compensated for by the lush Baroque beauty of this planet, and using, I guess, some soundstage where they shot other sword and sorcery epics or whatever. They did a lot with a little, which is amazing, and this is something that should be seen by people.
And Bubba was, I mean, he was famous for that. They would give him a budget and a schedule, and he would return the film under budget and before schedule. The man was just incredible. He was a maestro.
Mm-hmm.
There's no two ways about it. The man was a master. So, star rating for Planet of the Vampires.
Oh, well, I'm going to give it 3.5. Interesting visually. Interesting conceit, too. Anytime you have someone investigating something that happened to another vessel and seeing some nefarious outcome. We discussed this in the Luigi Cozzi movie Contagion. Even though that was a ship in the Hudson River in New York City, it doesn't matter. That might as well have been in space. There were some space elements in that movie. But when you have people exploring an unexplored world, there's tension right there.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't know what's around the corner. You have internecine tension where people are being affected by the atmosphere. You have the tension of what's out there, how the other ship is being affected. There's lots going on in this movie, and it was quite ahead of its time. I mean, you've got to love it for that. Yeah, and your star rating.
Yeah, we give it 3.5 as well. I mean, it's not the top of the top, Baba. It's not your Black Sundays, your Black Sabbaths, your Twitch of the Death Nerves or whatever. Those are your 4.5s and 5s. But, you know, there's also, and there's been a few Baba films later in his career that are down to your 1s, 1s and 2s. But, yeah, this is a solid 3.5 for me. If you're a Baba completist, you owe it to yourself to see... Heck, if you're a sci-fi fan, you mm-hmm. owe it to yourself to see Planet of the Vampires. It's just...
Yeah, and an extra layer of tension is also the fact that they can't escape without performing some technological feat via Wes, this Mr. Scott version from Star Trek, of this crew here who has to fix this ridiculous gizmo.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not like some typical film where it's like, okay, we've gotten away. There's an atmosphere they have to breach. They have a pretty big challenge ahead of them to get out of here.
And then, of course, they have the hostile forces they have to contend with. So
And I love the mix of newfangled space age technology with the old school of this time technology. Again, the aforementioned nameplates, which they had, a la their, you know, some server in a, you know, 2-bit pub. And the other one is the cutting torch, which is just hilarious because they have this high-tech laser weaponry that they're using to explore. But in order to breach, you know, the doors that get shut on them in the galleon when they're trying to escape that vessel, and they're using a cutting torch. It's like a shitty welder, you know. That's the level of technology they're using for that. In addition, the drawbridge. And I got a kick out of the captain, who's not only a dispassionate man of science, but he's not very hopeful for a positive outcome. As he does one of these things, like, what is it that Captain Kirk does? Message from... Stargate message. What's the thing
like
he does?
Captain's log.
Stargate, whatever. He does this version of it where he says, the situation is hopeless. So he's basically given up, and then one of his crew comes in and he stops the recording. But he's basically conceded that things are foobar.
The captain should not be afraid. And I confess now to whoever may hear this that today, now, I am experiencing fear. I must not let my crew know this. I must keep them busy. I must not let them know that the situation appears more hopeless with each passing day. Dictated by Captain Mark Markery of the spaceship Argus.
Another funny thing about Captain, my captain, you know, or Intrepid Captain. I mean, again, like, you know, you would think he's a man of science, scientist. I mean, observation is a big thing. I think this man, like, he likes the empirical nature of science, because at one point when him and Sonya are exploring the alien ship, you know what I'm talking about.
They have a device to communicate, and it causes a shock to Sonya. And then
she touches it, goes, "Oh, it shocked me."
Yeah.
And instead of observing, believing, what does Mark do?
He replicates her experiment, and he gets shocked as well. Like, couldn't you have, like, oh, yeah. And that makes me laugh, too, speaking of ancient ridiculous technology. When you tune your guitar, you have a tuning fork, and this sounds a 440, I think, megahertz frequency of an A, the note A. So you hit it, ding, and then you tune your guitar to your A string. Here, the stupid alien race that perished, who has Easter Island skulls, and they're like, you know, 40 times our size, they communicated they had some sort of buried tuning fork that they communicated with, and in some instance here, they were trying to figure out how to use this fork to do something to escape their ship.
Yeah.
I was like, wow, that is some pretty basic technology there. And they do make fun of, we won't spoil that. I was going to say there's some earthly technology that they make light of later, but we're no spoilers here.
Right.
What did you learn?
Was that what you learned?
Yeah, I learned a lot here.
Well, yeah, did we mention at the very beginning that this movie is titled Planet of the Vampires, mm-hmm. and there really are no vampires in it. This was released in Italy before it was picked up for distribution by AIP, and it was originally had a very appropriate title, Terror in Space. Then when AIP picked up for distribution, they went through 15 different titles before settling on Planet of the Vampires. One of them would have been Planet of Blood, which again would have been a bit more appropriate. But for some reason, they decided to go with Planet of the Vampires. Now, there's really nothing vampiric about any of the hostile forces on this planet. But I guess, you know, vampires was in vogue at the time. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe this is around the time of Christopher Lee, in the Hammer films as Dracula, so Planet of the Vampires it was. What I learned is that, but I love it. Like, I love the P.T. Barnum-esque aspect of the AIP, Sam Markoff, etc. Whatever's going to sell the picture, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, exactly.
If we're going to give a Telson misnomer, it doesn't matter. All we want to get are asses in the seats from the matinees and cars in the lot for the drive-in so that teenagers can, you know, do a little necking, a little petting, mm-hmm. and enjoy the double bill. So it's a lost period of cinema, which I sort of miss. And I just, yeah, it's wonderful.
Oh, you can't beat a bunch of doohickeys, a bunch of switches, a bunch of levers, a theremin, that ridiculous Russian instrument going. That's great automatically. You have to have that in every sci-fi movie. This had some neat, again, as we talked aesthetically, there were some weird swirls, like a logarithmic, like, seashell that they're walking through. There's really neat stuff on this planet. I want to see more of the planet, and again, just doing a lot with a little. Typical sci-fi movies to this day, for the last 20 years, have been blue or green. Yeah, cinematography and the post-production tint, or taint, if you want to say, of that these films always have, where they always look the bloody same.
Right.
This thing was, from their uniforms to the ship, to the atmosphere, to the planet, everything was different. There's something neat to look at, and credit to Bava for this. So, and I'm happy you recommended it. We're always, not always, but sometimes at a loss for what we should watch when we podcast every week. And, you know, this one was just great. I'm so happy to have seen it. Yeah, so kudos to you for suggesting it. And I'm looking to fill out my Bava dance card and watch everything he's ever done. Why not? And the same thing with Argento. When you have so much, when you're such a master of visual style like these two men are, you have to check out everything they've done. Mm-hmm. The worst things they've done are still pretty damn good. There's something to behold.
And as I said before, Bava, I mean, it's worth going outside of the horror genre. And as I said before, checking out, for example, Danger Diabolique, which is one of my favorite Bava films, and there's nothing horrific about it. Hercules in the Haunted World, I mean, there is a little bit of horror there, but it's probably one of the most interesting, you know, 1960s sort of sound films I've ever seen. So, yeah, when it comes to Bava, you know, of course you have your towering masterpieces, your Black Sabbath, your Black Sunday, and all the wonderful giallos, but the man was so much more than that. A real treasure. Wonderful filmmaker.
For sure, and for more, check out our website, www.reallyawfulmovies.com, and of course, our podcast with new episodes uploaded every Friday. Send us your suggestions, reallyawfulmovies@gmail.com, and we'll talk to you soon.
Take care.
Thank you.